said, "Those are for your father and his assistant after we land." I didn't say anything. I just looked stonily around. When the colonies were settled, they took horses to work and ride, because tractors and helipacks have such low reproductive rate. There weren't any opportunities to set up industries on the colonies, simply time enough to drop people and enough supplies to give them a fair chance to survive. Then, the ships would head back to Earth for another load and another destination. Those supplies included very little in the way of machines, because machines wear out in a few years. They did include horses. Nowadays, when we land on a planet when they haven't made any progress in the last 170 years, we ride horseback, too. At that time, of course, I hadn't learned to ride yet, and I was a little shy of horses. When one was led past me and wrinkled its lips and snorted, I jumped back. I noticed the toilet then. We were only a few feet away from it. I looked up at the giant and said, "I have to go to the bathroom." Before he could say anything, I was inside with the door locked. Escaped, for the moment. I didn't have to go to the bathroom at all. I just wanted to be left alone. I looked around at the bare-walled room. I ran the water and washed my hands. Altogether, I managed to stay inside for a full 5 minutes before being alone in the little empty room with my nervousness. Got to be too much for me. I kept imagining that Daddy was on board by now, and I even thought that I could almost hear his voice. Finally, I was driven outside to see. When I opened the door, the giant was standing exactly where I had left him, obviously waiting for me. There were people moving things on board. The horses were locked in their stalls and moving around, and Daddy was still outside somewhere. Exactly as though I'd never been gone, the giant said, "Come on upstairs," in his deep voice. "I'll show you my buttons. I keep a collection of them there." Resignedly, I preceded him up the flight of metal stairs that led upstairs, winding around a vertical hand pole like threads winding around a screw. It was obvious that he was determined to keep me in his charge, and I wasn't feeling up to arguing, even if I dared to. At the top, we came out in a bubble dome in which two seats were hung on swivel pivots, a slanting panel directly in front of them with inset vision screens, dials, and meters, the slant of the panel low enough so as not to obscure vision out the dome. And beside these, perhaps enough room to turn around twice. The giant waved a paw at the console at the base of the panel. "My button collection," he said, and smiled. "I'll bet you didn't think I had any." They were there. Enough buttons to keep a 2-year-old or a pilot occupied for hours. It was obvious that in his way, this George was trying to be friendly. But I wasn't in the mood to be friendly with any large, ugly stranger. After one brief glance at the panel and console, I turned away to look outside. Through the dome, I could see the rock roof glowing gently all above us. The ring of the scout ship's body cut off the view directly beneath us, and I couldn't see Daddy or the men with him at all. It's no fun to be deserted. It's a miserable feeling. This George said, "Your father will be a little while yet." Feeling caught, I stopped looking for him and turned back around. "Sit down," the giant said, and somewhat warily I did. The chair bobbed on its pivot as I sat down. I kept my eyes on George. He leaned carelessly against his panel, and after a moment, he said,
"Since you don't want to seem to talk, and we have to be here together for a while yet,
let me tell you a story. It was told to me by my mother the night before I went on trial." And with that, he launched full into it, ignoring the fact that I was too old for such things. "Once upon a time," he said, "there was a king who had 2 sons, and they were twins, the first ever born in the country. One was named Enigin and the other Britabal, and though one was older than the other, I don't remember which it was, and I doubt anyone else does either. The 2 boys were so alike that not even their dear mother's heart could tell one from the other, and before their first month was out, they were so thoroughly mixed that no one could be sure which to call Britabal and which Enigan. Finally, they gave up the whole thing as a bad lot, used their heads, and hung tags on the boys and called them Ned and Sam. They grew up tall and strong, and as like each other as two warts on the same toad. If one was an inch taller or a pound heavier at the beginning of the month, by the end of it, they were all even again. It was all even between them in wrestling, running, swimming, riding, and spitting. By the time they were grown-up young men, there was only one way to mark them apart. It was universally agreed that Sam was bright and Ned was charming, and the people of the country even called them Bright Sam and Charming Ned. "Hark!" they would say as a horse went by on the road. "There goes Prince Charming Ned!" Or, alternatively, "Hey! Mark old Bright Sam thinking under yon spreading oak." The boys did earn their names, and honestly. Ask Sam to do a sum, parse a sentence, or figure a puzzle, and he could do it in a trice. Whereas Ned just wasn't handy at that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you like charm and heart, courtesy and good humor, Ned was a really swell fellow, a delight to his dear mother, and a merry ray of sunshine to his subjects. While Sam, at his best, was a trifle sour. Then one day the old king, their father, died, and the question arose as to which son should inherit, for the kingdom was small and the treasury was empty, and there simply was not enough for both. The great council of the kingdom met to consider the problem. They met and considered and voted and tied. At first they said it was obvious that the elder son should inherit, but they found that no one at all could say which was the elder. Then an exasperated soul proposed that the younger should inherit, and all agreed that was a fine way out, until they discovered that it was equally problematic which was the younger. It was at this point that they decided to vote to settle the question. But the vote turned out a tie, for half said, "A king should be bright, so as to be able to rule intelligently and deal wisely with the friends and the enemies of the kingdom. Nobody really has to like him." And the other half said, "A king should be beloved by his subjects and well thought of by his neighbors and peers. The council can always provide the brains needed to run things, if brains are ever required." At last, finally, and in the end, it was decided by all that there was only one way to settle the matter. Charming Ned and Bright Sam must undertake a quest, and whichever of them was successful would become king of the realm and take his fine old father's place. If neither was successful, they could always bring in a poor second cousin who was waiting in the wings, hat in hand. Kingdoms always have second cousins around to fill in when they're needed. The quest decided upon was this. It seems that many miles away, or so the story had come to them in the kingdom, there was a small cavern in which lived a moderate-sized ogre with a fine large treasure, big enough to handle the kingdom's budget problem for some years to come. It was agreed that whichever of the two boys could bring the treasure home where it belonged would have proved to the satisfaction of everybody his overwhelming right to be king. At this point, the story was interrupted. One of the three crewmen stuck his head up through the stairwell and said, "We're all tight, George. Miles says we can leave any time now." George said to me, "Strap yourself in there," and pushed the button that locked himself into his own seat. Humming slightly to himself, he rapped a switch with the back of his hand and rumbled, "10 seconds to drop. Mind your stomachs." In 10 seconds, the rim bars pulled back, and we dropped slowly into our tube, and then out of the ship. I was leaving home for the first time. Geoquad, even at its worst, was still us, rather than them. As we dropped into the tube, the dome went opaque around us, and lights came on. There was none of the stomach-upsetting moment of transition as we shifted from the artificial gravity of the ship to the artificial gravity of the scout ship of which George had just warned us, though there might have been. Which meant that whatever else he might be, this George creature was a relatively effective pilot. I still didn't know how to take him. I have that when I first meet people. I have to get used to them slowly. For the moment, too young for me or not, I was content to have him go on with his story, because it gave me something to think about instead of Grano and whatever I would find there. He punched buttons for a minute, and then said,
"Well, that ought to hold us for a while. Now, where was I?"
"The ogre and the treasure."
"Oh, yes,"
he said, and continued with his story. Well, the two young men set off the very next morning, when the sun was up and the air was warm. Sam, intelligent as always, had loaded food and supplies into a knapsack and put it on his back, and buckled a great sword around his waist. Ned took nothing, too heavy, you know, but simply put his red cap on his head and walked on down the road, whistling. Everybody in the kingdom came down to the road to wave and see them off. They waved until the boys were around the first bend in the road, and then, like sensible folk, they all went home to breakfast. Sam was loaded so heavily that he couldn't walk as fast as his dear brother, and Ned was soon out of sight ahead of him, without even the sound of his whistle to mark him. This didn't seriously bother Bright Sam, because he was sure that preparation and foresight would in the end more than make up for Ned's initial brisk pace. When he got hungry, not having any food would slow him down. But Sam walked a long time, day and night, and never saw his brother. Then he came on the skinniest man he'd ever seen, sitting by a great pile of animal bones.
"Hello," Sam said. "I'm looking for an ogre who lives in a cave and owns a treasure. Do you know where I can find him?"
At the question, the man began to cry. Sam asked him what the trouble was, since, sour or not, he hated to see people cry. The man said,
"A young fellow stopped a day or two ago and asked me the same question exactly, and he brought nothing but trouble on me. I had a flock of sheep, and fine ones too, and I was roasting one for my dinner when he stopped, and he was such a nice, pleasant fellow that I asked him to eat with me. He was still hungry after the first sheep, so I killed another, and then another, and then another. He was so friendly and charming, and so grateful, that I never noticed until he had gone that he had eaten every last one of my animals. Now I have nothing at all, and I'm starting to get hungry myself."
Sam said,
"If you will tell me where the ogre lives, I will give you some of the food that I have with me."
The man said,
"Give me some of your food, and I will tell you just what I told that other young fellow."
So Sam gave him food, and when the hungry man was done eating, he said,
"The answer is that I don't know. I don't have any truck with ogres. I just mind my own business."
Sam went on down the road, with his pack a bit lighter than before. He walked a long time, day and night, and never saw his brother. Then he came on a little castle in which lived a princess. Well, perhaps not a princess as most people reckon it, but since she lived there alone, there wasn't a single person to say she wasn't. That is how royal families are founded. This little castle was being besieged by a very rude and unpleasant giant. As a passing courtesy, Sam drew his sword and slew the giant, lopping off his great hairy head. The princess, and pretty indeed she was, came out of her castle and thanked him.
"It was very nice of you," said she, "but I'm afraid that the giant here," and she nudged his head with the toe of her dainty slipper, "has 7 brothers, and the whole lot take turns besieging my castle. This will no doubt make them a bit angry. I used to have a charm that kept my land protected from all such creatures, but alas, no longer. A young man with a red cap came whistling down the road last week looking for an ogre, and he was so sweet and charming that I gave him the charm to protect himself with and keep him from harm. And ever since, these horrid giants have been attacking my castle."
"Well, why don't you move?" said Sam. "There aren't any giants where I live, though we do have a dragon or two, and we have some very nice castles looking to be bought."
The princess said that sounded like a very nice idea, and she just might take his advice.
"By the way," said Sam, "do you know, by chance, where I can find the ogre you were speaking of just a minute ago?"
"Oh, certainly," she said. "It's not far at all. Just follow your nose for 3 days and nights, and you'll be there.
Sam thanked her, slew a second giant come to look for his brother, and went on his way. He followed his nose, and after 3 days and nights, it told him that he had found the ogre's cave.
He knocked politely, and the ogre came out.
The cave was a bit small for him. He was covered with hair, and he had 3 red eyes and 2 great yellow fangs. Other than his appearance, he seemed friendly enough. Sam drew his sword and said,
"Excuse me, but I've come for your treasure."
"Well, if you can tell me a riddle I can't guess," said the ogre, "I'll give all I have to you. But if I do answer it, I want your money and all that you have."
Sam agreed. It is common knowledge that ogres are not bright as a rule, and Sam knew some very hard riddles indeed. He thought he did. And finally he said,
"What is it that is not and never will be?"
The ogre turned the question over in his mind. Then he sat down to really think about it. For 3 whole days and 3 whole nights they sat there, and nobody thought it odd of them, because nobody lived nearby. The ogre tried 12 answers one by one, but each time Sam said,
"I'm sorry, but that's not it."
Finally, the ogre said,
"I can't think of any more answers." "You win, but don't tell me the answer. Write it on a piece of paper. I can think about it after you're gone."
So Sam wrote his answer down on a piece of paper and gave it to the ogre. Then he said,
"And now, could I trouble you for your treasure?"
The ogre said,
"You won all that I have, fair and square. Just a minute."
He went inside the cave, and in just a moment he was back with 1 single brass farthing.
"I'm sorry, but that's all there is. There used to be more, but I gave it all to a nice young man who was here just 1 week ago. I had to start all over again after he left, and now that you've beaten me, I'll have to start even another time."
Because he knew his brother well, Sam asked disbelievingly,
"This young fellow didn't ask you any riddles you couldn't answer, did he?"
The ogre drew himself up and said in a wounded tone,
"Of course not. But he was such a nice young fellow that I couldn't bear to let him go away empty-handed."
Well, that left Sam with something of a problem. He'd beaten the ogre and won his treasure, but nobody was likely to take 1 single brass farthing as proof of that. So he thought for a minute, and then he said,
"And how do you find your cave for size, my friend?"
"Cramped," said the ogre, "but good caves are hard to find."
"And do you have much company here?"
"No,"
said the ogre.
"I think on my riddles to pass the time."
"Well," said Sam, "how would you like to come along home with me? When I'm king at home, I can provide you with 1 fine large cave and pleasant neighbors, and send people with riddles to you from time to time. How about that?"
The ogre could hardly turn an offer like that down, so he agreed readily, and they set out together. When they got near home, it was apparent to Sam that 1 celebration was going on in the kingdom. He said to his ogre friend,
"How would you like to go to a party?"
"Oh, fine," said the ogre. "I'm sure I'd like a party, though I've never been to one."
"Well, I'll go in first,
and then I'll come out for you in a minute," said Sam.
He went inside to find that there was 2 celebration in progress. His brother Ned was about to be crowned king and to marry the sweet princess that Sam had sent home. Sam thought that was most unkind.
"Stop the wedding," said Sam.
They stopped the wedding and looked around at him. He said,
"I succeeded at the quest, and I claim the right to be king."
Everybody laughed at him. They said,
"Charming Ned brought home the ogre's treasure. What did you bring?"
Sam showed them 1 single brass farthing.
"I brought this," he said,
and they all laughed the more.
"And I brought 1 more thing,
he said, and threw open the doors. In walked the ogre,
looking for the party he'd been promised. Sam explained to the ogre that the party would begin straight away the moment he became king. Since the ogre was standing in the only doorway, Sam was made king in no time at all. Well, after that, Sam set the ogre up in a cave of his very own, and after the neighbors found he wasn't a bad sort, he got on quite well. The ogre became a regular tourist attraction, one of the finest in the kingdom, and brought in a nice regular bit of revenue. Sam opened a charm school with his brother Ned in charge, and that brought in even more money. Sam married the princess himself, and everybody lived quite happily from then on. If they haven't moved away, and I don't know why they would, they'll be living there still. Oh, yes, it took the ogre a full 10 years to decide he couldn't answer Sam's riddle. Every week he would bundle the answers he'd thought of together and send them to Sam, and Sam would send them back. Finally, the ogre decided he would never find the right answer to the question, "What is it that is not, and never will be?" He opened the paper Sam had given him so long before, and took a look. The answer was, "A mouse's nest in a cat's ear." And that, my little friend, is the only real, true answer there is.
"Oh, hell," said the ogre. "I was just about to guess that."
"There's a moral, too," George said. "My mother told it to me, and I'll tell it to you. If you're bright and use your head, you'll never go too far wrong. Just keep it in mind, and you'll get along."
Right after that, we reached the atmosphere of Grano. George was busy with his buttons. I was thinking that he meant well enough, and I was feeling a bit more friendly toward him. I had gathered that entering a planet's atmosphere was a tricky business, but George didn't seem particularly concerned. The main problem was the same as when leaving the ship: to strike a balance between one gravity field and the other, so that the people aboard were not plastered against the floor or left suddenly without any feeling of weight at all. Besides that, he had to take us to the point on the planet to which we were going, and how he did that, I couldn't tell. Apparently, he got bearings from his instruments. The dials and meters said incomprehensible things to me, but by some strange gift of tongues, he understood them. He switched on the vision screens, and they showed nothing but a billowy gray blankness beneath us. Without any coaxing from George, the dome above our heads became first translucent and then gradually transparent, our interior lights fading in correspondence to the increasing light from outside. As we descended, I looked all around through the dome. I was still feeling apprehensive, but my curiosity was getting the better of me. I freed myself from my chair and strained to see all I could, but it wasn't heartening. In every direction the view was the same, a slightly rolling gray whiteness that looked soft and bouncy, lit uniformly by the red-orange sun that was low in the sky ahead of us as we traveled, and gradually rose higher. It was the first sun I had seen at close range, and I didn't like the glare it gave off. The automatic polarizer in the dome reduced the brightness until it was bearable to look at the bright disk, but I could see its light was unpleasant. The vision screens showed the same bouncy amorphous whiteness directly beneath us as we moved. I said, "That isn't what a planet looks like, is it?" George laughed and said, "Those are clouds. The planet's down underneath. It's like frosting with cake under it." He reached to rap at the same switch he'd turned on before and saw it was on. He frowned and then made an announcement to the people below. "We'll be setting down in about 10 minutes. He hit the switch and it popped up.
"I'm going downstairs," I said.
"All right," George said. "I'll see you later."
He turned his attention back to his job, and we suddenly sliced down into the gray-white clouds and were surrounded by the sick, smothering mass. The lights came up a little in the dome to restore the life that was missing in the grayness outside. It was the most frightening stuff to be lost in that I could imagine, and I didn't want to look at it. I went down the spiral stairs, and in the warm haven of the room below, I looked for Daddy.
He was sitting in an easy chair by himself in the center section. Mr. Tubman, Daddy's assistant, was watching while the horses were saddled. Men were bustling around doing those last-minute things that people always discover 5 minutes before it will be too late to do them. Daddy had a book and was reading quite calmly, as I might have expected. Daddy ignores confusion. I sat down in a heavy brown chair beside him and waited until he looked up. He said,
"Hello, Mia. We're just about there. How are you doing?"
"All right, I guess."
Meaning I was nervous. "Good. And how are you getting on with George?"
I shrugged. "All right, I guess."
"I've asked him to keep an eye on you today while I'm in conference. He'll show you around the town. He's been here before."
"Are you going to be busy all day long?" I asked.
"I think so. If I wind things up before dark, I'll find the two of you."
I had to be satisfied with that. A few moments later, we touched down smoothly for a landing. Grano had heavier gravity than home. That was the first thing I was certain of after all our motion had ceased. I could feel the extra weight as a strain on my calves and arches when I stood up. Something that would take getting used to. George came downstairs and walked over to us. Daddy stood up and said,
"Well, all ready to take over, George?"
Meaning me. George towered over both of us. He nodded. Daddy smiled and said,
"That was a pretty good story, George. You have talents I never suspected you of having."
"Which story?" I asked.
"The story George was just telling you," Daddy said. "The speaker was on from the time we left the ship."
George grinned.
"I didn't notice that until just a minute ago." "It was a fine story," Daddy said.
I flushed, thoroughly embarrassed. "Oh, no," I said. To listen to a story like that was one thing, but to have everybody else know it was something else, and thoroughly disconcerting. I shot George an accusing look and then ran for cover, heading for the toilet again. I didn't want to be seen by anybody. Daddy was after me and caught me before I got to the separating partition. He grasped my arm and brought me to a stop.
"Hold on, Mia," he said.
I struggled to get loose. "Let me go."
"Don't make a scene, Mia," he said.
"Let go of me. I don't want to stay here."
"Quiet,"
he said sharply.
"I'm sorry I made the mistake of telling you.
But George didn't do it intentionally. Besides, I enjoyed his story, and I'm more than 6 times your age." "That's different," I said.
"You may be right. But whether you're right or not doesn't make any difference right now. It's time to go outside. I want you to pull yourself together and walk outside with me. When we face these Collins, I want you to be somebody I can be proud of. You don't want to show up badly in front of these people, do you?"
I shook my head.
"All right,"
he said, and let go of me.
"Pull yourself together."
Keeping my head averted, I did my best to get a grip on myself. I straightened my blouse and hitched my shorts, and when I was ready, I faced around. The ramp was down on the far side of the ship, and I could hear noise from outside, people shouting.
"Come along,"
Daddy said, and we walked across the center area. George was still standing there, and I gave him a hostile glance as we passed, but he didn't seem to notice. He fell in behind us. We paused for a moment at the top of the ramp, and that seemed to be taken as a signal for a band to start playing and for people to yell even louder. Chapter 6. The horses had already been led outside and were being held there by Mr. Tubman. Standing beside him was an officious-looking man in a tall hat, in which was placed a great wilted white feather. At another time, he might have been funny. There were 2 children with him, a boy and a girl, both somewhere near my age. We had sat down in what must have been the main square of the town, and there were ranks of people yelling and staring up at us from either hand. It made me feel on display. The sky was low and gray above us. The yellow bricks of the square were wet and shiny, and there was a warm, damp breeze. The band was directly in front of us, all of the band members dressed in dark green uniforms. They played enthusiastically. Loudly, that is, but badly. I was looking all around at this, but Daddy took my arm and said, "Come on, you can gawk later." We started down the ramp, and all the people in the square increased the volume of their noise. I didn't like it, and started to feel very nervous. I wouldn't like being yelled at by large numbers of people in any case, but this was all the more discomforting, because I couldn't tell from the noise whether they were friendly or not. Whatever tune the band was playing became indistinguishable, and simply added a small contribution to the general hubbub. Daddy and the officious-looking man shook hands. Daddy said,
"Mr. Gennaro, it's good to see you again."
The man said,
"You timed things well, Mr. Havero. The rain stopped here less than an hour ago, though I won't guarantee that it will stay stopped."
Daddy nudged me forward.
"This is my daughter, Mia. I believe you've already met Mr. Tubman and George Huonin, my pilot."
As I shook hands, I took a good look at him. He had an eager-to-please manner that I didn't know how to take, and I couldn't get any clue from Daddy's face or tone. Gennaro indicated the boy and the girl with him.
"These are my children, Ralph and Helga. When you said you were bringing your daughter, I thought she might like to meet some children of her own age."
He turned on a smile, and then turned it off again. The boy had dirty blonde hair. He was just a shade taller than I, but much more squarely built. The girl was also squarely built, and about my size. They both said hello, but not in an overwhelmingly friendly way. I said hello just as cautiously myself.
"That was very thoughtful," Daddy said to Mr. Gennaro.
The man said,
"Glad to do it, glad to do it. Anything to keep up goodwill, ha ha."
The band and the people continued to make noise.
"Shall we be going?" Daddy said.
"Oh, yes," Mr. Gennaro said. "Children, mind your manners."
Daddy didn't say anything to me, but simply gave me a sharp look. Mr. Gennaro mounted his horse, and Daddy and Mr. Tubman swung up on theirs. The band, still playing, backed off enough for them to pass through, and they clattered off and out of the square. The band followed after, still playing loud and tinnily, and a good portion of the crowd trailed them. I said, "Why is everybody following after Daddy?"
"Your father is a celebrity,"
George Huonin said in an ironic rumble, standing just behind me. I hadn't been speaking to him, just voicing my thoughts, but I was reminded that I had determined not to speak to him, ever again. So I moved away a little. A section of the remaining crowd pressed forward toward the scout ship, bent on getting a good close look at us. George looked out at them with no particular sign of pleasure, as though he'd like to shoo them away.
"Stay here,"
he said to me.
"I'll be right back."
He walked up the ramp to the place where the three crew members were standing. They were lounging in the mouth of the ship and getting a big kick out of the crowd. When George came up, they said something that sounded like a joke and laughed. George didn't laugh. He shook his head irritatedly and motioned them to go inside.
"What do we do now?"
the boy, Ralph, said to his sister, and I turned back to look at them. On the ship, we have such long lives and low population that you never see brothers and sisters closer than 20 years apart, never as close together as these two. All the kids I know are singletons. I don't know what I was expecting to see, but except for build, this brother and sister didn't look much alike at all. I had thought they would. In books they always do. Either that or exactly like their long-lost Uncle Max, the one with all the money. Helga had dark hair, though not as dark as mine, and it was quite long, hanging down to her shoulders and tucked in place with combs. She wore a dress with a yoke front. Her brother wore long pants like those Daddy had put on to wear today, and a plain shirt. They had both obviously done some grooming for this little ceremony, and it made them look as stiff as their manners. I suppose I looked just as odd to them as they did to me. I was a short, dark little thing with close-cut black hair, and I was wearing what I usually wore, a white blouse with loose sleeves, blue shorts, and high-backed sandals. It was a costume I would have felt comfortable in at almost any sort of gathering within the ship. I wouldn't have worn exactly that to play soccer in. Something a little less formal, actually, and harder shoes. But I was presentable. My clothes were clean and reasonably neat. However, after the glory of all those dark green uniforms, I could see that these kids might consider what I was wearing just a bit lacking in elegance. We looked at each other for a long, starchy moment. Then the boy unbent a little and said,
"How old are you?"
12, I said.
"I'm 14, he said. "She's 12.
Helga said, "Daddy told us to show you around." She said it tentatively. I took a deep breath and said, "All right." "What about him?" she said, pointing to the ramp. George was standing just inside the ship with his back to us. "He told you to stay here." "He's supposed to watch me, but I don't have to pay any attention to him," I said. "Let's leave before he comes back."
"All right," Ralph said. "Come on, then."
He ran under the high rim of the scout ship, in exactly the opposite direction from Daddy and his own father. Helga and I followed him. George saw me as I started off, and yelled something, but I just kept on running. I'd be damned if I'd pay any attention to him. Ralph made a slight detour to tag the lower bulge of the ship. Maybe to be brave and have something to tell about afterward. Maybe just to do it. And then dashed on. We went all the way under the rim of the ship and out the other side. There were a few people there, but a much smaller crowd than on the side where the ramp was lowered. Possibly because there weren't any ship people to stare at over here. We charged through them, and I noticed that they were all squarely built, too. We left them looking after us and dashed around the first corner we came to. I was feeling pretty daring in my own way, as though I were cutting loose on a great adventure. We took a couple of quick turns from one street into another, and if George was following after, he was soon left behind. By that time, I had no idea of where we were. It was a street, like the others we'd been in, made of rounded stones and about the width of a large hallway at home, with buildings of stone and wood, and a few of brick on either side. "Hold on," I said. "I can't run anymore." My legs were aching and I was out of breath. It took a lot more effort to get around here than it did at home, and I had no doubt that if I fell down, it would hurt more. Grano was a planet that was what they called Earth-like to 9 degrees, as were all the colony planets, but that 1 degree of difference offered a great deal of latitude for the odd or uncomfortable, including Grano's slightly stronger gravity. That slightly stronger was enough to tire me in almost no time.
"What's the matter?"
Ralph asked. I said, "I'm tired. Let's just walk." They exchanged looks, and then Ralph said,
"Oh, all right."
The air was a little hard to catch your breath in. It seemed so thick and warm, it felt wet. Something like walking through stew, and about as pleasant as that. "Is the air always like this?" I asked.
"Like what?"
Helga asked, with the barest hint of a defensive edge in her voice.
"Well, thick."
I could have added, "and smelly, too," since it carried an odd variety of odors I couldn't identify. But I didn't. They always prayed about planetary fresh air, but if this was it, I didn't like it.
"It's just a little humid today," Ralph said. "This breeze that's coming up now should clear the air."
We started that afternoon, by all being a little afraid of each other, I think. But very quickly Ralph and Helga found out how silly their fear was, and pretty soon, when they didn't think to mind their manners, the contempt that replaced the fear slipped out. It took me a while to see what it was.
All I knew was that they found a lot of what I said foolish, and made it clear that they found it foolish, and that they did a lot of exchanging of significant glances. I found I didn't know anything. I didn't even know what time it was. I said something about the morning, something that made it clear that I thought it was morning, and they both turned on me. Turned out it was lunch here, no matter that I had stared at my breakfast just before we left. I pointed at a building and asked what it was. "That's a store, silly. Haven't you ever seen a store?" Well, I hadn't. I'd read about them, and that's all. We have such a small society on the ship that buying and selling aren't really practicable. If you want something, you put in a requisition for it, and in a little while it comes. You can live as simply or as lavishly as you want. There's a limit as to how much you can jam into one apartment, though some people do live up to the limit. In a society where anybody can have just about anything he wants, there's no real prestige in having things unless you use them or get some aesthetic pleasure from them. So I would say the tendency in general is towards simple living. I can think of only one regular program of exchange on the ship. Kids under 14 are given weekly allowance chits to draw against in the common room snack bars. That way, none of them get a chance to ruin their health. After 14, they assume you know what you're about and leave you alone. "Can I take a look?" I asked. Ralph shrugged.
"All right, I guess."
It was a clothing store, and most of the clothes looked very strange to me. There were even some items I couldn't figure out. After a minute, the man who ran the place came up to Ralph and said in a loud whisper,
"What's he dressed like that for?"
"She's a girl," Helga said, "and she doesn't know any better." My ears went red, but I pretended I didn't hear and just kept poking through the rack of cloaks I was looking at.
"She's down from that ship," Ralph said in a whisper as good as a shout. "They don't wear clothes up there. She probably thought that junk she has on is what we wear."
The man sneered and quite deliberately turned away from me. I wasn't sure why, and I was puzzled because it was obviously meant to be offensive. He only stopped short of spitting on the floor at my feet. It seemed excessive if it was only because I didn't have the sense to dress like a proper girl in the horrible things he had to sell. As we went out, the storekeeper muttered something about grabby that I didn't catch. Ralph and Helga didn't seem to notice, or pretended they didn't, and said nothing. We had just left the store and turned the corner, starting on a long downhill slope, when I stopped still and said, "What's that?"
"What?"
I pointed at the dead gray mass, tipped with white, that stretched across the bottom of the street, blocks away downhill.
"Is that water?"
They looked at each other, and then in a "any blockhead should know that much" tone of voice, Ralph said,
"It's the ocean."
I'd always wanted to see an ocean, since they're even rarer on the ship than stores. "Could I take a look?"
"Sure," Ralph said. "Why not?"
First, there was a stone wharf and warehouses stretching away on either hand. The harbor stretched two great arms around to enclose a large expanse of water. At the sides were wooden docks on pilings running out like fingers into the harbor. Close at hand were boats of all sizes. Nearest were the great giants with several masts big enough to have smaller boats tied on board. There were medium and small boats tied up at all the docks. Even in the harbor, the water ran in white crested peaks and slapped noisily at the stone and wood. There were birds of white and gray and brown and black and mixtures of all these colors, all wheeling around and crying overhead, and some of them diving down at the water. The air down here smelled strongly. Of fish, I think. Outside the harbor, the water was running in mountains that made the peaks inside look small, and it stretched away farther than I could see clearly, to join somewhere in the distance with the gray sky overhead. I might have made comments about all the things I saw, the odors, the men working, but I didn't know what to say that wouldn't strike Ralph and Helga as amusing, and by that time, I was starting to be a little cautious about exposing myself. I was seeing them as something less than the allies they had been when we were running from George.
We walked along the waterfront, and off the quay, and onto the wooden docks. Ralph led us out onto a little spur, and we stopped there. He pointed down at a little craft tied alongside. It was about 12 feet long, with a mast that stood up high enough to reach above the dock. It had a boom that was lashed in place. It was painted a serviceable white with black trim, and had the odd name Guacamole painted on it.
"What do you think of her?" he asked.
"It's a very nice ship," I said.
"It isn't a ship. It's a boat. A sailing dinghy. And it's ours, Helga's and mine. We go sailing all the time. Want to go for a sail?"
Helga looked at him, obviously pleased.
"Oh, can we?"
"If she'll go," Ralph said. "It's up to her. Otherwise, we've got to do what Daddy said and stay with her."
"Oh, do come on,"
Helga said to me. I looked at the water and tried to make up my mind. The water looked rough, and the boat looked small. I really didn't want to go at all. Helga said,
"We'll just stay inside the harbor."
"It isn't dangerous," Ralph added, looking at me.
I didn't want him to think I was scared, so after a minute, I shrugged and started down the wooden ladder that reached from the dock down to the rear of the boat. The ladder stood about 2 feet above the dock at its highest point, and I grabbed it and backed down. I seemed to be seeing more of ladders lately than I really cared to. Ralph and Helga started down after me. The boat was rising and falling on the water as the swells came in to break on the docks and the quay. I waited until the boat was rising and then stepped in. I almost slipped, but I held my feet and then moved carefully to the front, grabbing on when I had to. When I got by the mast, I sat down on the seat that ran across the front. Helga dropped into the boat as I was sitting, and Ralph was right behind her. I blinked a little as a trace of spray wet my cheek.
"Aren't we going to get wet?" I asked.
They didn't hear, and I repeated my question in a louder voice.
"It's just spindrift," Helga said. "You've got to expect that."
"We won't get too wet,"
Ralph said.
"Besides, the water will get you clean. I know you don't see much water in your ship."
That was another thing that irritated me about Ralph and Helga. They had all sorts of misconceptions about the ship, which they insisted on trotting out. Ralph was worse because he was dogmatic. I thought at first he was being malicious, until I realized he actually believed what he was saying. Like that bit about going naked. That wasn't completely wrong. Some people do go without clothes in the privacy of their own apartments. But I would like to see somebody trying to play soccer while completely bare. The point is that what he said wasn't quite right either, and he wouldn't listen. He would just say his misconceptions flatly and expect you to agree with him. Right at the beginning, he said something about how it was too bad we had to live in crowded barracks, something along that line. And didn't I like all the space here? I tried to explain that that was only the way it used to be on the ship, right at the beginning. But then I made the mistake of bringing in the dormitories, which are a little bit that way, trying to be honest. And that only confused the issue. Ralph finally said that everybody knew what things were like, and I didn't have to try to explain. Helga was a little more bearable, because she only asked questions.
"Is it true you don't eat food on your ship?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, they say you don't grow food like we do. That you eat dirt or something."
"No," I said.
"And
is it true that you kill babies who are born looking wrong?"
"Do you?"
"Well, no.
But everybody says you do."
The thing that really annoyed me about Ralph and his "water to get you clean" remark is that we on the ship had very clear memories of how dirty the colonists had been. Ralph apparently wasn't even able to notice the horrid odors that clung to the whole harbor, which demonstrated how defective his sense of smell was. But I still didn't like the blithe, "of course," way he said it. Ralph and Helga got the sail up in short order, while I watched. And then Helga came up by me, untied the bow, and sat down. Ralph untied the stern and we pushed off. He had a little stick tiller to steer with and held the boom by a line. He put the boom over, and the breeze filled the sail with an audible flap. We started from the right-hand curve of the harbor with the wind behind us, and sailed across the long width of the harbor. The chop of the waves and the spray were annoying, and the grayness of the day wasn't very nice. But I thought I could see how, given better weather and time to get used to this sort of thing, sailing could be fun. Uncharitably, though, I couldn't help thinking that we handled weather much better on the third level than they did here. When we wanted rain, everybody knows it's coming ahead of time. We throw a switch, and it rains until we want it to stop. And then it stops. None of this thick air with its clamminess. As we were sailing, Helga started a conversation, trying to be friendly, I think. She said, "Do you have any brothers and sisters?" "No," I said. "I don't think so. I never heard of any." "Well, wouldn't you know? I mean, half-brothers and half-sisters, too." "I don't know for sure, but I was never told of any. My parents have been married so long that if I had a brother, he'd be all grown or dead years ago." This may seem strange, but it was an idea that I'd never entertained before. I just never thought in terms of brothers or sisters. It was an interesting notion, but I didn't really take it seriously even now. Helga looked at me with a slightly puzzled look. "Married? I thought you didn't get married like regular people. I thought you just lived with anybody you wanted to." I said, "My parents have been married more than 50 years. That's Earth years."
50 years?
"Oh, you know that isn't so. I just saw your father, and he isn't even as old as my dad."
"Well, how old is your dad?"
"Let's see," she said. She did some obvious figuring. "About 50. I said, "Well, my dad is 81, Earth years." She looked at me with an expression of total disbelief. "Oh, that's a lie." "And my mother is 74, or 75. I'm not sure which it is." Helga gave me a disgusted look and turned away. Well, it was true, and if she didn't want to believe it, too bad. I won't say it's usual for people to be married as long as 50 years. I get the impression that people tend to get tired of each other after 20 or 30 years and split up. And there are some people who don't want anything as permanent as marriage and just live together. And people who don't even know each other who have children because the ship's eugenist advises it. Whatever Helga had heard, it had been a garbled or twisted version of this. My parents were a strange pair. They'd been married for 50 years, which wasn't usual, and they hadn't lived together for 8 years. When I was 4, my mother got an opportunity she had been looking forward to for the study of art under Lemuel Carpentier, and she'd moved out. I guess that if you've been married as long as 50 years, and apparently expect it to go on for maybe 50 years more, that a vacation of 8 years or so is hardly noticeable. To tell the truth, I didn't know what my parents saw in each other. I liked and respected my father, but I didn't like my mother at all. I'd like to say that it was simply that we didn't understand each other, and that was partly true. I thought her art was plain bad. One of the few times I went to her apartment to visit, I looked at a sculpture she'd done and asked her about it. "That's called The Bird," she said. I could see that it was meant to be a bird. Mother was working directly from a picture, and it looked just like it. But it was so stiff and formal that it had no feel of life at all. I said something about that, and she didn't like the remark at all. We got into an argument, and she finally put me out. So part of it was misunderstanding, but not all. For one thing, she'd made it quite clear to me that she'd had me as a duty, and not because she particularly wanted to. I firmly believed that she was just waiting for me to go on trial, and then she'd move back in with Daddy. As I say, I didn't like her. When we got to the far side of the harbor, instead of coming directly back, as I somehow thought we would, Ralph turned us so that we were traveling out at an angle toward the mouth of the harbor. Traveling that way,
We were running at an angle through the waves, too, and the chop increased tremendously. We would go up in the air, and then quite suddenly down again. And after a few minutes of this, I was starting to feel queasy. It was a different sort of upset than I'd been suffering earlier in the day. This was nausea, and accompanied by a whirling in the head. I said to Helga, "Can't we go straight back? I'm starting to feel sick." "This is the quickest way back," she said. "We can't sail directly into the wind. We have to tack, head into the wind at an angle."
"But we're going so slow," I said. It was the slow way we rammed into waves, surged high, and then pitched down on the other side that threw my stomach off stride. Ralph yanked on the line that was attached to the boom and swung it over from one side of the boat to the other, turning the tiller at the same time, and we headed back in toward the quay in another slow tack. By that time, I was feeling miserable.
"Don't throw up," Helga said cheerfully. "We'll be back soon enough."
Then she raised her voice.
"You've had it your fair turn, Ralph. Let me take over."
"Oh, all right," Ralph said, quite reluctantly. Helga ducked back to the stern, taking the tiller and the boom line from Ralph. She nodded at me.
"She's feeling sick," she said.
"Oh," Ralph said. He came forward and sat down beside me. He looked at me and said, "It takes a while to get your sea legs. After you sail for a while, you get used to it." He didn't say anything while we completed that leg and part of the next tack. He just watched Helga a little wistfully. I began to think that this sailing thing, provided first that you were feeling well enough to enjoy it at all, was much more fun for the person actually doing the sailing than for the passengers. Helga and Ralph, at least, both seemed to be having much more fun when they were sailing than when they were sitting up front. Perhaps it was just that they felt they had to talk to me, and that was an effort for them. Ralph said,
"Well, how do you think our fathers are getting along?"
I swallowed, trying to keep control of my stomach. I said,
"I don't know. I don't even know what they were going to trade for."
He looked at me in surprise.
"You don't even know that? We operate placer mines just to produce tungsten ore for you. We ship it all the way here and you don't even know it? Why don't..."
I paused and grabbed hard onto the side of the boat, gunwale, and fought hard to hold on to my composure as we dipped into a sudden trough.
"Why don't you mine this stuff, whatever it is, just for yourselves?"
Somewhat bitterly, he said, "We don't know how to reduce it. You ship people won't tell us how. When we trade with you, all you give us is little bits and pieces of information." We were heeling over into our last tack then, about to head down the last stretch to the dock. I said,
"And why not? We preserve all the knowledge through the years since Earth was destroyed. If we gave it all to you, what would we have left to trade with?"
"My dad says you're parasites," he said. "You live off our hard work. You're grabbies, and that's no mistake."
"We are not parasites."